You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Today's Real Vision Daily Briefing is brought to you by Chintai, your partner in asset tokenization. Licensed and regulated by Singapore's Monetary Authority and powered by the innovative CHEX token, Chintai offers a compliant, one-stop solution for bringing real-world assets on-chain. Chintai enables the tokenization of virtually any asset, from carbon credits to corporate debt, private funds, and real estate, enhancing liquidity and optimizing efficiency for all.
The technology becomes largely invisible and seamless to the end user. I can take a selective store of value within a wider portfolio in a fairly liquid form, very efficiently, to anything, whether it's some high-value whiskey, whether it's a particular supercar that's a one of three limited edition, therefore in this fungible trading of them in a liquid form, is the true end game here for tokenization.
With billions of dollars in client deals facilitated, explore how you can take advantage of tokenization by visiting realvision.com/chintai.
If you want to participate in the upside of crypto but don't have the time or the inclination to go truly down the rabbit hole, then Real Vision Crypto might just be for you. New from Real Vision, an RV crypto subscription gets you access to a trading basket complete with risk management strategy, technical analysis updates, private Discord channel, monthly drinks online, and more. And it's led by a team of RV favorites, including Chris Bullock, Jamie Coots, Peter Pinkosoff, and more to be announced soon. So, barely have time to listen to the end of this ad, but want to take part in this crypto cycle without having to dedicate all of your time to figuring it out? Go to realvision.com/RV crypto. That's realvision.com/RV crypto to see if RV crypto is the right fit for you.
What's the biggest geopolitical risk to the market? Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Maggie Lake. With me today is Peter Zion, Chief Strategist and author at Zion on Geopolitics. Hi, Peter. It's great to have you back on.
Good to be here.
So tensions are running high. I think that's probably an understatement, but it's in so many different areas of the world. We have Israel and Iran. We're still trying to figure out the outcome of that. And of course, what's happening in Gaza. We have Russia, Ukraine, the South China Sea, and of course, the U.S. election. Throw on that, widening campus protests. So there's a lot going on. And, you know, we've had these periods where it's really sort of on the radar of markets and investors. And there is, I think, a degree of concern, but also confusion, right? But people trying to figure out, how does this impact me? How does this impact my investments? So when we just look across everything that's going on, what's top of mind for you? What are you most worried about, or what are you paying the most attention to?
The situation in China has gone from bad to horrific. The new demographic data that's been leaking out in bits and pieces over the last 9 months basically indicates that the replacement generation that the Chinese thought they were going to get back in 2000 never materialized. And now we're in a situation where the birth rate's actually dropped by almost 50% in just the last 5 years. So the capacity of China long-term, not simply to be a manufacturing power with workforce, but simply exist as a coherent industrial power is now impossible. And it's just a question now of how do we get from here to the end? Obviously, the Chinese government would prefer that end date to be as far in the future as possible. The challenge they're facing, the challenge we're all facing, is that the American birth rate, as low as it is, has now been higher than China's for 30 years. And so they've simply run out of people under age 40. So the only way that the Chinese have found that they can remain any degree of international competitiveness is to force their people to work long hours, subsidize the crap out of all the industries, and since the people are working all the time, push down their consumption and force their capital into government-led investments in some way. Well, that leaves you with this huge overhang of industrial product that has to be exported. And so we're at the beginning edge of what will be the last great wave of Chinese product dumping. It's captured everyone's imagination in the electric vehicle space, and that's very, very real. But that's only one small sliver of what's coming. And unlike previous times when some version of this has happened with one country or another, this time the Americans, the Japanese, and the Europeans are not only ready, they're prepared to put into place trade practices that will smash as much of that incoming product as possible. So we're standing today at the beginning of the greatest trade conflict we have seen since the 1920s.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there. I have a couple of questions myself, but as we know, our audience always turns up anxious to hear your views.
Yeah, they're so shy.
I know, and they are shy as well. But very seriously, it's a great point. So you're so right about the electric vehicle space, right? We've seen what's happening there, and we've seen the impact on a lot of the companies in that space, the products in that space. We've been getting a lot of questions about them. Andrew asking, you know, we know that you've been feeling like China has been in this decline. When we're talking about broadening out from electric vehicles, and Andrew, I'm going to paraphrase here. Let's take chips, for instance. I think you've been bearish on their ability with chips, but he's saying, yet Huawei sold multiple tens of millions of their new phones, hurting Apple sales significantly. You know, so how does that sort of jive with what your thoughts are about them being unable to, you know, just having to dump this stuff and unable to kind of get these products and get traction in their own country? Because that's a good example of where it looks like they're succeeding.
For a fashion, you got to look what's under the hood here, though. Key thing to remember about technology in China is that there's kind of two categories. There's the ones, the things that they can do all by themselves without any sort of help from anyone else. In terms of chips, that's 90 nanometer and worse. So basically Internet of Things quality. And then the second category is what they can do when they have external technology that they can apply. And then the third category, I guess you'd want to get even more aggressive here, are the things that they can't do at all, but they really, really want to. So the high-end chips definitely fall into that category. They can make chips up to roughly 28, 26 nanometers with a hefty amount of external help, not just for the lithography, but especially for the quality checks on the wafers. So when you make a semiconductor, for example, you've got this giant Volkswagen-sized crystal of silicon, you slice off a disk of it, and then that is what you etch and dope and bake. You have to do that somewhere between 30 and 90 times based on the quality. And the quality checks on those disks, that's not done by Chinese workers. That's done almost exclusively by foreign workers. So that's the weak point there. But if you throw in bottomless subsidization, which they have, and a hefty dollop of nationalism, which they're not shy about using, you can get the Chinese population to purchase products that the government basically points about. And the Huawei situation falls into that category. So what they did was they took an older technology called deep ultraviolet, and they used it to adapt a pre-existing chip design, because they can't do that part even for the dumb chips themselves. And they basically took a crypto mining chip and made it as high-end as they could with the DUV technology, and then stacked it on top of itself to put it into the phone. It was a very brute force way of doing things, very, very power intensive, took up a lot of space in the phone. And on a side-by-side comparison, it might be a fairly fast chip, but only for a certain number of things, and it burns through the battery at light speed. But it was a nationalist success because they were able to do that with the tools they had on hand at the time. I don't mean to say that they weren't clever in doing that, but it wasn't a fresh design. They didn't make it using their own technology. So you don't want to overextend the argument that they've broken free of sanctions.
Hey, everyone. We're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing. Today's Real Vision Daily Briefing is brought to you by Chintai, your partner in asset tokenization. Licensed and regulated by Singapore's Monetary Authority and powered by the innovative CHEX token, Chintai offers a compliant, one-stop solution for bringing real-world assets on-chain. Chintai enables the tokenization of virtually any asset, from carbon credits to corporate debt, private funds, and real estate, enhancing liquidity and optimizing efficiency for all.
The technology becomes largely invisible and seamless to the end user. I can take a selective store of value within a wider portfolio in a fairly liquid form very efficiently to anything, whether it's some high-value whiskey, whether it's a particular supercar that's a one of three limited edition, therefore in this fungible trading of them in a liquid form, is the true end game here for tokenization.
With billions of dollars in client deals facilitated, explore how you can take advantage of tokenization by visiting realvision.com/chintai. You've heard the headlines. Inflation is unchecked. The dollar is collapsing. The government is printing too much money. The fear is real, but there is a solution: gold. The government can't print more gold. Gold isn't collapsing, and gold's value increases during inflationary times. Noble Gold Investments is here to help you protect your wealth. Noble Gold Investments is the gold IRA company that Americans trust. The founders of Noble Gold have more than 20 years of combined experience in buying gold and silver. They've secured more than $1 billion in precious metals for their clients. Whether you're a seasoned investor or new to the game, Noble Gold Investments simplifies and secures your gold investment journey. Choose between a tax-advantaged gold IRA or have physical gold delivered to your door. Noble Gold Investments ensures a seamless and easy transaction. Invest in something you can hold. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com/vision to get started. Don't wait. That's noblegoldinvestments.com/vision.
Right. It worked there, but this is not a sort of, you know, a model that they're going to be able to build on and replicate.
Probably not, because they can't design chips themselves.
Right. Which is why we see so much tension over the issue of chips. So when it comes to flooding the world, let's just say we say that they start to ramp up the export machine. You know, there was a time when that meant a deflationary force in the world, cheaper prices for consumers. We're coming up on elections. Consumers are pissed off about prices. They don't like things high. Why is this going to end in a trade war as opposed to some welcome relief on the inflation front or some cheaper prices to help take the pressure off?
This is going to be an employment issue. What we've seen since COVID is an explosion in the earning potential for like the bottom third of the job market. Well, that's the third that normally works in manufacturing. So if we're going into an election season and we have Chinese product flooding the market, especially in things like EV, which are not a low-end product for most American citizens, you're talking about job losses in the market that has been most impacted by globalization in the past. It's a story that people find familiar. And so both parties have taken up this very strident anti-China policy. And you now have what's left of the Republicans and what's left of the Democrats basically screaming at each other that they're tougher on China. And considering that everyone's competing for those union jobs, they have a vested interest in doing just that.
Yeah. It's like saying you're not going to run on NAFTA now. You're not going to run on open the door to China. Does it look like a full-on trade war regardless of who wins the U.S. election?
Yeah, exactly. It would be a difference in style. People forget that on foreign economic issues, Trump and Biden are the two most similar presidents we've ever had. Every tariff that Donald Trump put into place, save one, Biden has actually codified into the bureaucracy so it outlives him. They're almost the same person from that specific point of view.
Do you think do you think the voters know that?
Oh, that you're asking me to crap on the vote. Well, I'm not running for office. I don't think
it
that
seems
is really
like, I mean, to listen to the campaigns, that's not going to be the line. Like, oh, these two guys are the same.
There's plenty of issues in which they are very opposed. That's just not one of them.
Mm. So someone, we were having a geopolitical conversation a couple of weeks ago, and somebody, Marco Popovich, said that the U.S. election is the macro black hole. Because it's so hard.
Sounds like Marco.
Yeah, to game out what's going to happen here. In the past, you've been pretty confident that you don't think Trump could win this. The polls suggest otherwise. You can say what you say about polls, but how do you see this playing out? And I think importantly, what do you think the issue is going to be that drives this election?
Well, let's start with the polls. No American political poll that was taken before the convention has ever been correct. So I'm not going to start listening to them now at this point. Come back to me in a couple months and then we can talk about that. But there's three reasons why Donald Trump has no chance. Number one, Donald Trump picked a fight among the Republican coalition and there are fewer Republicans than Democrats. So if he can't get 100% of Republicans to show up, he's lost right there. Number two, people have forgotten that during the midterms, the independents swung very, very strongly against anyone who Trump put his finger on. Because Trump basically told the independents that the general election doesn't matter. And they said, watch us. Well, the Republicans have never won a national election without carrying at least a 2-to-1 majority among the independents. So he's lost right there. And then the third thing is RFK Jr. Donald Trump thought he had cornered the batshit crazy vote, and now it's split. There's no path to victory here unless Joe Biden dies, which is a non-zero risk.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have both of them that are at their advanced stage.
Trump is like an hour and a half younger than Biden. So yeah, non-zero risk there too.
I mean, it is hard to quantify what would happen in that event. I mean, it doesn't seem like, does it seem like anybody has a plan if either of them,
because
you have the health issues on Biden's front, but you have other issues. Well, we don't think health, but we don't know, but we also have this trial and we don't know what's going to come out from that. It doesn't appear that it matters to voters, but does either party have a plan to put someone in place? Do we know even how that would work? And would that be viewed as positive or would or negative? I mean, these are a lot. It's hard to
game
that one out.
Really matters. On the Democratic side, if Biden were to die before the convention.
And this is a terrible thing to discuss, by the way.
But we have to, because they're both 180 million years old.
And investors, you know, are always trying to figure out probability of risk. So
yeah, both of them are clearly mentally deficient. Both of them are clearly failing and both of them are older than dust. So we have to talk about it. So if Biden were to die before the convention, then the Democrats could actually have an open, honest effort, if severely truncated, to come up with another candidate. And I would think that the party machine of the Democratic Party is still sufficiently intact to have that convention. If Biden were to die after the convention, then it's Harris and all bets are off. On the Republican side, Donald Trump has gutted the Republican National Committee of everyone who was willing to say anything other than the fact that Trump is a wonderful person and the election was stolen from him. And so that institution is no longer capable of holding any sort of open debate about the future of the party or who a post-Trump candidate would be. You would think, because Nikki Haley actually has a fistful of delegates, that it would automatically be her. But I think it's entirely possible that Donald Trump has so gutted the party that he would still be nominated even if he was dead.
No. So you, I know you've just been out on the road and you've been talking to all sorts of different people for 3 weeks. Does it matter to investors who wins or who are they most afraid of winning?
Yes. The thing to keep in mind about what's going on with the business community, or really the economic community at all is a better way to phrase that, is that the unions left the Democratic coalition and Trump kicked the business community out of the Republican coalition. So for the first time in the history of the Republic, there's no one who can do math in government. They're completely on the outside. It's a very uncomfortable position for both, especially for the business community. But until the parties settle and reform, which is still a few years away, this is just the environment that we're in. And so it's a question of, you know, which side of this poisoned coin do you want to take a bite out of?
Yeah. I think it's why it's unnerving, including from a foreign policy point of view, because it's hard to, some of the things you would rely on as predictable, even if you connected it to a party or something, seem to be out the window. What about the Fed? Because that was a story that blew up over the weekend, that if he were elected, Trump may try to bring the Fed under the executive branch, give the president more power over what the Fed does. It was knocked down pretty quickly. But it did seem like a trial balloon that was floated. What's your reaction to that? And how do you think that would go down with the business community?
It wasn't a trial balloon. Nothing that comes out of the Trump team is a trial balloon. It's Trump's straight thoughts. And whether
they were people who were maybe trying out for his economic team is how it was postured by some.
Yeah. Well, so, all that tells me is that Donald Trump told the people who were trying out for his economic team that that's what he plans to do. Now, he can't do that without an act of Congress, and probably more than one. So the degree to which you'd have to have it, not just a Trump victory, but a strong coattail victory, is extreme to make that happen. I just don't see that in the cards.
So not a risk. So I know the Fed came up when you were talking to investors. What are they concerned about?
There seems to be this growing realization among the financial community that the Fed doesn't like them very much. And I think that's our overall an accurate assessment. Let's start from the petty and then go to the non-petty. So on the petty side, the Fed is increasingly vocal about blaming the investment community for not just the subprime crisis, but the dot-com bust 25 years ago. And, you know, there's an argument to be made there. Credit was too cheap. The business community took it some strange directions, and we all paid the price for it. But the bigger reason, the deeper reason, is demographic. Because if you think back to the period from roughly 2000 to 2020, that's the period when the baby boomers were shedding their kids, had paid down their houses, but they hadn't yet retired. And so the largest generation we've ever had was at their most capital-rich moment for a two-decade period. And so the whole world was flooded with baby boomer, and especially American baby boomer capital. And we couldn't absorb it all. So we needed this large financial sector to figure out what to do with it. And that has been the story for most of the people in Wall Street for the last 20 years, 25 years. Well, that's not the environment we're in anymore. Half of the boomers have already retired. They've taken their potential high-velocity investments and put them into low-velocity investments because if you're retired, you don't want to be in the derivative market. You want T-bills. All of a sudden, you've got this huge financial overhang in labor, a sector that is supersized, and the amount of capital is shrinking. So there's not yet a recognition among the financial crowd that maybe we don't need all of them anymore. But we're getting there. And this disconnect between what the investment community thinks should happen with rates and what the Fed has made it very clear is going to happen with rates is getting wider and wider by the moment. And the investment community is looking more and more out of touch. And that's going to last until we have a reckoning. Now, I don't mean to suggest that it's like right around the corner. This is a demographic issue. These things tend to be glacial until the day that they're not. I don't think we're at that day yet. But we're not going back to where we were in the aughts and the teens. This is something that will take another generation before we get to a period of relative capital richness.
So the financial sector or Wall Street, at least Wall Street that services it, will have to shrink. Do you think that the Fed is interested in keeping rates higher to benefit savers?
Higher for longer does not mean rates don't drop for another 2, 3, 4 months or 2, 3, 4 quarters. Capital costs are going to be high until we have another large generation like the boomers hitting that capital-rich period in their lives. Those will be the millennials, and that won't start until 2035. So we have a long path ahead of us here, and even if that works out perfectly, even if the millennials enter their capital-rich period of their life on time, they've done everything else 6 years later, but let's say they do this on time, well, there's still a problem with demand. What is monetary policy if not a series of tools to regulate demand? And if you look around the world, of the top 20 economies, more than half of them have now aged out that they will never be demand-driven again. That includes China and Japan and Korea and Germany and Poland and Italy and Spain. So we're in a very different macroeconomic environment now, driven by demographic factors, and that's our new normal. And people just haven't adjusted to that fact yet. The China angle that we started with, that's what it looks like from a manufacturing side and a trade side. The finance teams, they haven't quite assimilated this yet.
What do you make of all of the protests we're seeing on college campuses?
I heard somebody yesterday tell me that conservatism dies in a room with Trump and liberalism dies on college campuses. We have had a complete disconnect on the left and on the right of civics and education for now 20 years, and we're now seeing the outcome of that, unfortunately. I don't think there's much of an economic angle to this, and I hope that it's not going to last too long, But you combine that with social media in an election year, and we're going to have some weird shit go down between now and November.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
I ask because, you know, although they're kind of being tagged under this Palestinian issue or response to what's happening with Israel and Iran, they're not just in liberal colleges in the Northeast anymore. It's kind of spreading everywhere. And this is a very large voting bloc if they ever decide to go to a poll, which they haven't really done. But if they do, it's a, we don't know. We don't know what that would mean.
From a data point of view, I'm not saying this from an ethical and moral point of view, but from a data point of view, it's really good that it's spread because it'll give us an idea for how many of these protests are real involving students versus from bad actors who have come onto college campuses, which very clearly went down in the Ivy League schools. Right. So, you know, there's a big difference between Iowa State University having a protest and Columbia having a protest because there aren't enough bad actors in the country to flood them all. If it turns out to be just students and it's based on principles, however wayward we might find those at times, it's a different sort of situation.
Yeah. If I was a pollster, I'd want to listen to what they're protesting Absolutely. About because I suspect it's about more than I suspect it's a general frustration.
Well, and also if
that's my personal theory.
If it is a bad actor situation, like we saw with the Ivy Leagues, when people came on to report and do polls, they got beaten up. Those weren't Ivy League students doing the assaults.
Yeah. 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 It's going to be interesting. It's interesting for it to happen now ahead of the election. So we've got some great questions coming in. I just want to make sure we haven't even touched on the Middle East. We haven't touched on oil, but I just want to circle back on China because we will inevitably get this. So if China is, you still feel like in this demographic dire straits, and when you're talking demographics, this is a long-term trend. This isn't a tomorrow trend. So I just want to, we always talk about time frame when we're talking about these things. So I'm guessing that this is a longer time frame that you're talking about.
I hope so.
Are there any military implications from that? Because we know Japan was just in for a state visit. You know, there are always people who are concerned about everyone getting distracted away from what's happening in the South China Sea, and that being really where the focus should be. How does that demographic
It's a popular argument to say that when a country is dying, it's going to lash out. And there have been historical examples of that going down. But that means you have to have a period of relative strength, and the Chinese don't have that. In addition, we've seen the cult of personality in China be so strict that it's gutted the ability of even local governments to make coherent policies. To think that their military is the only part of their society where merit matters, that's a stretch. And we discovered over last summer that the corruption within the procurement system for the Chinese military was every bit as deeply rooted as the corruption within the Russian military procurement system. So I don't think that the Chinese military is the threat that a lot of people think it is. I don't mean to minimize the concern here, but if there was a war, you don't fight it at Taiwan. You fight it in the Indian Ocean. Because this is a country that imports 80% of their energy, 80% of it comes from the Middle East, and 80% of the components that they use to grow their own food follows the same route. So if there is a war, you send a few ships in the Indian Ocean basin, you cut those arteries, and China faces a post-industrial collapse complete with a famine in under a year. Now, 5 years ago, Chairman Xi knew that. But 5 years ago is about when he purged the last people who would tell him anything that he didn't want to hear. So it's entirely possible after 5 years of blind propaganda that he's forgotten.
So we have a great question because everyone here is worried about. Someone asked, what do you, and this is directed at me as much as you, I think. What do you, can you please define investment community? Jack's asking. Everyone with a 401k. I think, yes. When I'm asking Peter about investors, I think Then I'm talking more about Wall Street, fund managers, people who manage money, but more broadly, when we're talking about, it's all of you, it's all of us, right? We all have money at stake here because we all have to look after ourselves for our pensions in the US. If you've got a fixed pension from Europe, good for you. It's pretty much dead here. So all of us, I would consider the investment community. So a bit of both, Jack. I hope that answers your question. But Christopher wrote with that in mind, or somewhere was disappeared, but just wondering, like, so what does this mean for my money? So instead of going around regionally, I'm going to go like more asset class right now, I think, or sort of investment buckets. And let's talk about oil. So there was a spike in a concern when we saw what happened with Israel and Iran. That seems to have subsided, and it didn't get as high as some had feared. We still have Russia banging on. And you were just talking about the Russia-Ukraine situation. You were just talking about how much China is reliant on oil imports. Also, India. There have been some that have suggested that in order to make sure they keep getting what they need, that India has a sort of technology expertise to go into Russia if they need engineers, go into anywhere they need to, Venezuela, anywhere, to make sure that these, you know, big countries with this big need can find the oil they need.
Well, let me start with the good news in the oil markets and then go to the bad news. The good news is that so far I've been wrong about Russia. They've managed to keep it running. Now, no one else can go in there and help them. The only countries that have permafrost experience are European or American. The Indians can't play there. The Chinese or the Japanese can't play there. But for the moment, that oil is still flowing. And for the moment, the Germans, the Americans are in agreement. They would prefer to not disrupt those flows. So while sanctions and lack of maintenance and war damage remain a threat and may very well bring about the end of the Russian complex in time does not mean today. It could change tomorrow because there's so many bad things in play, but at the moment, that is stable. The Chinese hitting the skids in terms of consumption has also bought a little bit of room to stabilize things a little bit, which is nice. On the Venezuelan situation, the Maduro government has consciously chosen to make Venezuela a failed state. And there are only three countries in the world that have the technical expertise to keep Venezuelan crude moving. And the Americans are at the moment trying to decide if the two of them that are American are going to be part of that play. Looks like they're probably going to be pulling out, but total exports out of Venezuela have been under 1 million barrels a day for a while now. So if that was all to vanish, it wouldn't be a big deal. The last wild card, if that's the right term, is Iran. And we seem to be in a situation now where the Iranians and the Israelis have agreed to let bygones be bygones for the current moment. So from a supply point of view, we look okay. It doesn't look like there's any imminent disruptions. And the Chinese taking a bit of a breather from a demand point of view is giving everyone else a little bit of wiggle room. In terms of longer term, nothing looks great because all of the Russian fields are either very old, maintained by foreigners, or both. So we know we need to prepare for a world where that goes away. Whether that's in 2024 or 2030, I don't know. They certainly won't make it to 2035. And that's the world's second largest source. As for the Persian Gulf, the Iranians and the Israelis may be getting along at the moment. But if Israel, Saudi Arabia, the Gulfies, the Americans, and the Turks have their way, we're going to have basically all of the Arab countries on one side and Iran on the other. And in that sort of environment, both sides will perceive it's in their best interest to inhibit oil exports because it would drive up the prices for whoever is able to keep the market supplied. So when you have the oil producers entering a situation where they see disruption as a positive, very different world.
So it sounds like you think oil prices are going to head higher based on
time, yes. But this is based on a whole series of political calculations that are done day by day by day. And at the moment, no one has made the decision in that direction.
Ethan, I think that answers your question. And the thing to really focus on there is just because you have from what you're saying, Peter, just because you have technological expertise or engineering or, you know, technologists or all of that, it depends on the type of oil and how it's drilled.
The physical environment, the geology, the climate, and the legal environment. And in those four cases, what's going on in Northern Russia and what goes on in Venezuela are unique. They have no parallel anywhere in the world. Very specialized knowledge base.
So in terms of Russia and Ukraine, we have a question in here from William, or a comment. The Russians are clearly winning the war, and all that NATO supplied equipment failed to deliver very much. Does it seem like Russia is winning this war?
At the moment, the Russians are certainly on a high. What's been going on for the last roughly 4 to 6 months, just to round it out, is the Russians have been able to push things into the front without fear of artillery. And artillery is always, in a land war, going to be the determining factor in the big picture. However, the Russians have not been able to capitalize on a single place where they broke the Ukrainian front, which is really confusing. A lot of the Russian generals, of which there are a lot, they're not very competent, have seared into their minds what happened when they advanced too quickly in the early weeks of the war, and they just had their troops cut to ribbons by guerrilla forces. And the Russians have never been good at advancing quickly with armor, because it's primarily an infantry heavy force, and the infantries are all conscripts. Also, every troop that the Russians began the war with are either now dead or injured and off the field, and everyone else who's come in has had at most 2 months of training before they get thrown into the meat grinder. So there's low morale, there's low capacity, there's low aggression, there's low ambition, there's low competence. And so you've seen gains simply because they're not getting shot back in a way that inhibits their attack. So after almost a year with almost no artillery shells, Kiev should be gone. I mean, that's the scale of the disruption to Ukraine supplies. But starting tomorrow, the first supplies from DC will make it to the front again. And we're probably going to have a very different conflict. Does that mean there's going to be a Ukrainian breakthrough? Anyone who thought they knew how this war was going to go, myself included, has been proven wrong. And then we all reassessed and made new forecasts, and we were all wrong again. So the best any of us can hope for is to highlight where things are changing and where there can be a breakthrough. And at the moment, I don't see a potential breakthrough on either side.
So this just grinds on.
At the moment, the Ukrainians and the Russians are both trying out new strategies. Because the Ukrainians didn't have artillery, they started making literally tens of thousands of 2-pound drones a month that are basically anti-personnel. And if you throw 4 or 5 of them into a tank tread, it can blow off the tread too. So it's a completely new weapon we've never seen in conflict, and the Ukrainians are already using it at a large scale. They're also using more traditional drones to do deep strikes into the Russian rear, not just going after military logistics like they've been doing since the beginning, but going after oil refineries. And they took 15% of capacity offline. That is one of the sort of things could actually eliminate a lot of Russian output, because if you take off more capacity for processing, that means there's not as much capacity left for throughput. And all it takes is one pipe backing up all the way to the fields to shut down entire sections of the Russian system forever, because the Russians don't have the technology to do the actual drilling anymore. They can only maintain. So that's something that if they hit the right thing at the right time in the right combination, you could see 1 to 3 million barrels of Russian crude fall offline within a week. Hasn't happened yet. And then, of course, on the Russian side, the Russians have proven, once again, that casualties are not the deciding factor. And they've started to put glide bomb kits onto their fab bombs from the Cold War. I mean, these are explosive bombs that have like a ton or two of explosive within them, like 4, 5, 6, 8 times what U.S. bombs have. They've always been dumb bombs before. That's why they haven't been using them. Because if, you know, if you throw a bomb and it doesn't even hit within a mile of where you're aiming for, it's a little embarrassing. But with the glide kits, it's hitting within a couple hundred feet. And for a 2-ton bomb, that's plenty. So not only are they using those on the front to break up the Ukrainian defense, they've started throwing them into civilian areas, specifically going after power plants. And, you know, if you get hit by an Iranian Shahid drone, you might lose a transformer that you can replace. If you get hit by a 2-ton bomb, there's not even a wall left to rebuild.
So, you know, if the Ukrainians are rearmed and we're going to face a new phase of this, we didn't see those commodity. We were just talking about how they kept the oil going. We also didn't see some of those commodity shortages or spikes the first time around. Does this look like a sort of, you know, grinding war of attrition with massive casualties going on, but in most cases, the supplies of natural resources and commodities keeps moving because everyone's kind of turning a blind eye and letting it?
I think that's a dangerous forecast to bet on. For a lot of people, that is their bet. And a lot of people in positions of political power. But there's so many things that can go wrong. And all the things I remember I outlined to you 2 years ago when this was starting, they are all still accurate. They just haven't happened yet, much to my surprise in many cases. If this becomes a grinding war of attrition, then the Russians will, in time, win. Because unless the Ukrainians can inflict more than an 8-to-1 casualty ratio consistently, the Russians just have more troops and more tanks. It's just an issue of math. And so the degree of damage the Ukrainians have to do in that sort of environment is extreme. I've had a number of battles where they've pulled that off, but not all of them. For Ukraine to win, this has to be a war of movement, where their inferior numbers can be compensated for with precision. And that requires a lot of support from the outside, which, as we've seen in the last year in the case of the United States, is not something they can always bet on.
Does it feel like having gotten that package through? What about Europe? Where's your Europe support? I mean, is Ukraine nervous that, you know, each time this might be the last time?
For the United States, yes, because the Russians have been uniquely capable of penetrating into our political sphere and basically writing the talking points for a number of people in Congress, which from any number of points of view as an American, I find problematic. The Europeans less so. I don't mean to suggest that there's not concerns about the war's specifics and generalities in Europe. There are. But there's a greater appreciation for the scale of the challenge in front of them. And so for each and every month for the last 11, the Europeans have given more money and more equipment than the Americans have. Mm-hmm. And we're also seeing significant spin-ups of their military industrial complex. The problem is that they're starting from such a low base. The United States, for all its faults, has been fighting the war on terror for the last 20 years. And so we have tooled up a lot of our military equipment manufacture over that time, and now we're repurposing it. For Europe, a number of countries, first and foremost the Germans, thought that history was done and war was over forever and basically shut down their defense department. And now they're having to go back and from scratch start up their military industrial complex. That's hard to do in a short time frame.
Yeah. What about Japan?
Japan is in a situation where they really, 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 really wish everybody would stop looking at them because they're quietly, 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 quietly trying to become a normal country again. And if they're going to become a normal country again with a normal military again that does normal deployments again, Ukraine is not their issue. China is their issue. They just put into full sea trials one of their new carriers, which was supposedly a helicopter destroyer. Stupid marketing. It's now been converted to do fighter jets for real. So Japan has rejoined the ranks of countries that have fully functional aircraft carriers. And that is something that is going to give the Chinese heartburn as long as they're around.
Yeah. Do you feel like the relationship between Japan and the U.S. is at a different stage now because of the threat of China?
Yes. Well, it's not just because of China, although that was definitely a prompt. For the last 15 years, the Japanese have seen the writing on the wall demographically around the world. They know that the global growth story that was driven by consumption is over. And then they see China, whether it's rising or going out with a bang, as a problem. And so they know that if there is a future for them economically or strategically, it has to be hand in glove with the United States. And so they cut a trade deal that was humiliating with the Trump administration. And unique among all the countries that Trump got a trade deal with, the Japanese did not push for changes as soon as the Biden administration came in, something that Joe Biden's team greatly appreciated. And so the question now is, how fast can we fold Japan into our defense strategies? I don't think they're ready yet. They don't have the expertise. They certainly don't have the crypto defense that is necessary for real deep intelligence and technological sharing. But these are things that they're working on.
So where do you see opportunity? It sounds like it's everything is filled with risk. Is there any opportunity?
Almost every risk has an opportunity on the other side. So, for example, if I'm right about China, about the way this is all going to end, if we still want manufactured goods, we just have to build them ourselves. And I would argue that the business community has been at least subconsciously moving in that direction for a few years. We've seen industrial construction spending increase by a factor of 10 in the last 5 years, which means it predates Biden and it predates the CHIPS Act. So I'm not suggesting that government can't be, theoretically at least, a positive contributor to this trend. but it isn't necessarily necessary. And we have a lot of industrial plant to build, and there's enough for everyone if they want to play. Some places,
so the private sector is it because they are making their supply chain more resilient? They're just doing it themselves.
Motivations vary company by company and sector by sector. That is definitely one of the top three.
So, because there have been some people who suggested this sort of, you know, deglobalization is actually, there's more rhetoric about it than reality, that it's not happening to the extent that people like to talk about it or specifically campaign about it.
I think we're still in the early days. We haven't seen the major disruptions because of political reasons. I think we will get there this year when it comes to things like EVs.
So you see anyone who can own their own manufacturing as being attractive, or somebody that can seize the opportunity, or a manufacturing themselves?
The challenge we're seeing already is that the model's shifting. So the model we had during the Cold War, and especially during the hyper-globalization period of 2005 to 2020, was you broke down every bit of manufacturing into the greatest number of steps. So each individual widget or part of a widget was made somewhere differently, and then you would bring them together into intermediate assemblies and final assembly. And so you would take a product that maybe used to be done in two or three facilities and break it down into 100. To get those absolute lowest cost, highest throughput manufacturers. Well, when you start introducing national security and concerns about jobs and reliability and strategic competition to it, that's a horrible model. And so when these things are coming back, it's not coming back as partial widgets. It's a more consolidated manufacturing model. And everyone is scared of going too far, because they don't know how much of China is going to fail. But everyone also wants to be first. So we're seeing a new model and a different scale with more consolidated manufacturing and fewer steps that are closer to the end consumer. But everyone still wants to like tap Vietnam for some of the
stuff. I was going
to
say, it sounds like you sound bullish about the US on that, but wouldn't it just go to the next low cost, low wage
country?
If
the model doesn't change, then yes. The problem is, even if the model doesn't change, there's not a billion industrial workers somewhere else in the world. So things, you pull it out of China, regardless of what the reason is, it's going to look different. And whenever you're going to change the industrial model of a product set, you're going to be taking risk. But the people who get it right, wow.
They're going to really get it right. What about India in this? We haven't brought them up, but they are in the middle of most of the conflicts. Not the middle, but they are not committed to each side. They've managed to try to stay.
The Himalayas are wonderful things. It insulates them from all kinds of crap.
Yeah.
So the Indians need to do the same thing that we have to do in North America. They need to vastly expand their industrial plant in order to make sure they have the manufactured goods they need. The problem with India is that everyone hates India and India hates everyone, especially in their own neighborhood. So India is the only country on the planet that doesn't have a free trade agreement with anyone. Even North Korea has one with China. So everything that we need to do, we can get help from Canada and Japan and Korea and Mexico, probably the United Kingdom before long, Colombia. India just has India. Now, yes, there's 1.5 billion Indians, and it's basically a half a dozen countries all in one anyway. But when you have to do it all yourself, it's going to take longer, it's going to be messier, it's going to be more expensive. And you know what I call that? India. This is an environment that Indians are very comfortable with. It is a huge growth story. It is an Indian story. They will not be integrating with anyone else.
Because there are a lot of people who look at that and say, oh, that's a great investment opportunity.
You realize that capital markets in India are scary.
What do you make of the situation with gold? Is anyone brought that up to you? Are we just seeing that happen because people are so unsure how to game out? Because everything that we've touched on, hard to see how it goes. There are big question marks with Russia, Ukraine, big question marks with the Middle East, you know, with China on the timeline, with Japan.
I mean, I I personally find it a little silly. We're not in an environment anymore where there aren't a lot of really clear positive investment plays because of all the industrial buildout that has to happen. I usually only think of gold when I have no idea what's going on. And it's very clear that we're seeing a huge industrial buildout in Southeast Asia and especially in North America. So there are ways to play this. And in an inflation index terms, gold over the long haul doesn't look all that hot, but it doesn't look all that bad. I've heard of dumber ideas.
What about Bitcoin? Somebody asked me about Bitcoin. We have not talked about that, you and I.
Let me give you the very short version. It's the Beanie Babies without the stuffed animals. Move on.
I'm take that. You're not a fan. You're not a
believer. No, it's just pointless. It had its moment when the baby boomers hadn't quite retired, and now it's just fluff.
So as we wrap this up, what are you going to be watching for most closely? We started out by saying, what are you worried? What's sort of top of mind for you when we're talking about opportunities? Well, it definitely sounds like you're bearish the financial sector that services some of this, just because we don't have that capital again until 2035, bullish manufacturing because of what's happening. So as we wrap this up, what is the thing that you're going to look for in the coming months?
Sure, I'll give you two. In Russia, I've been waiting for the other shoe to drop for 2 years. Still hasn't dropped. It's going to. Don't know when. Keeping my eyes on it.
Russia, yep. We always talk about that wild card being the fact they have nuclear weapons. Is that still as much of a threat? Because if you see the conversation, at least in Washington, it seems like there's so much more attention on Israel and Iran, and Russia's really moved to the back burner.
The American foreign policy community really has a hard time focusing on more than one thing at a time. And in an election year, to be perfectly blunt, Jews sell more votes than Russians.
So that'll be the focus. But you would still be concerned about the fact that...
Very. Very.
There's nuclear.
Yeah.
No, sorry, I interrupted you. So you're keeping an eye on Russia?
The second thing, and this shoe is in the process of dropping. The various bureaucratic support elements within the U.S. executive branch, as well as the European Commission in Europe, are drafting how they want to attack the Chinese industrial base and the export surge. The question is not whether, it's the specifics of how and when. And we're going to see movement on that easily before the elections.
And what's the response from China?
What
does that look like for consumer? If we're not getting their cheap goods, what's the alternative?
The problem is that the best way that the Chinese can retaliate is to do something that restricts their exports. And that's not something that helps them. So they have to look for something where they have a bit of leverage, where it doesn't translate into a direct boost for American and European manufacturing. I think the place you'll see that the most is in processed materials. So for example, turning bauxite into alumina, turning steel into pig iron, turning lithium concentrate into lithium metal. If you remember to last year, they did this with germanium and gallium. Products like that are places where the Chinese do have some very real leverage in the system. Keep in mind, rare earths are not in that category. Rare earths are not rare. The processing capacity exists across the world. It's just not on. If we did have a shortage of rare earths, it would be spun up in 6 to 12 months. But there are other things that are very, very real.
Peter, is always super thought-provoking to have you on. We love catching up with you. We had some great questions. Appreciate all of your deep thinking to those who are watching. Fantastic stuff. And we hope we get a chance to talk to you again, because this election is going to be one for the books, I think. One for the books. Who knows what's going to happen? So we'll check in with you as we get closer. Awesome. Thanks so much. And programming note for all of you, I wasn't here at the end of last week, but I think Ash gave you an update that we have a new product, a crypto product out. Even though Peter says it's Beanie Babies, there are a lot of people who disagree with him and are interested in it. So if you're earlier on the journey, you can check it out. Just go to our platform or our website, and you can find out where you need to see all of that and learn about it. And we'll be back tomorrow. Join us then. In the meantime, good luck and take care.
If you want to participate in the upside of crypto but don't have the time or the inclination to go truly down the rabbit hole, then Real Vision Crypto might just be for you. New from Real Vision, an RV crypto subscription gets you access to a trading basket complete with risk management strategy, technical analysis updates, private Discord channel, monthly drinks online, and more. And it's led by a team of RV favorites, including Chris Bullock, Jamie Coots, Peter Pinkosoff, and more to be announced soon. So, barely have time to listen to the end of this ad, but want to take part in this crypto cycle without having to dedicate all of your time to figuring it out? Go to realvision.com/RV crypto. That's realvision.com/RV crypto to see if RV crypto is the right fit for you.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.